Welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime. This edition originally aired on August 6th, 2011.
Molecules that may be useful in treating prostate cancer. Common chemical toxins in our bodies. I'm Florence Schwein, and during today's Journey to Wellness on El Paso Primetime, we'll be talking about both issues with my guest, Mark B. Cox, Ph.D. Mark is an assistant professor in the Border Biomedical Research Center of the Department of Biological Sciences here at the University of Texas at El Paso. Welcome, Mark. It's really a pleasure to have you here. Let me congratulate you first on your report on July 5th in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences Journal. It's about the discovery of molecules that may be useful in treating the most severe forms of prostate cancer. In layman's terms, please tell us about that research, Mark.
Well, first, let me thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a delight. Yeah.
So the research in my laboratory at UTEP focuses on the development of new treatments for prostate cancer. To put it in layman's terms, prostate cancer is much like breast cancer in that prostate tumors depend upon the body's production of testosterone for tumor growth, whereas breast cancer, estrogen promotes tumor growth. And so all of the current treatment options take advantage of that fact by cutting off the supply of testosterone to the tumor or blocking testosterone's action in the prostate. But also like breast cancer, prostate cancer can progress to a late stage where it no longer requires hormone or testosterone. And so because of that, at the late stages, the prostate cancer treatments that we currently use are completely ineffective because we no longer need hormones. So the treatments that block the production of hormone or action of the hormones is completely ineffective at that point. And so my lab is working on targeting new protein signaling pathways and things that will target these tumors even when they don't need hormone anymore. So
what about, I've heard about a treatment where they put in a seed kind of in prostate cancer?
Yeah, that's a delivery method.
So it's
a way to get your drug to the target organ, the prostate. So if it's a implantable drug of some sort, then it can be implanted directly in the organ. But all the current treatments target the production of testosterone or the action of that hormone in the prostate.
And at a certain point, the cancer no longer needs it.
And so those treatments are basically useless. So those who progress to late-stage cancer basically have very few treatment options. They can get as severe as castration because most of the testosterone in the human body is produced in the testicles. So worst-case scenario, they'll castrate the patient to completely cut off the supply of testosterone. Mm-hmm. And also some harmful chemotherapeutics that just target cell growth in general. So they're very toxic because they're targeting other cells besides the prostate tumor cells. Mm-hmm. So we really have no treatment options for late-stage prostate cancer. And as a result, anybody that progresses to that late-stage hormone-independent state have a very poor prognosis.
And so you're like a knight in shining armor here.
No, I wouldn't say that. My wife probably wouldn't say that. No.
But this affects a lot of people. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website, I read that more than 200,000 men in the United States are diagnosed with prostate cancer and about 30,000 die each year. So your work could have enormous impact in society.
So prostate cancer in general has a low mortality rate. So a lot of times it's seen as a not so severe cancer by people because if you get prostate cancer and it's in the early stages, it's treatable, et cetera, et cetera. But so many men get prostate cancer that we still see that many progressing to the late stage and actually dying from it. So we still have a high death rate, but if you look at the overall number of cases of prostate cancer versus the number that die from it, it's much lower than, say, breast cancer. But because 1 in 6 men will get prostate cancer at some point in their lifetime, right? So that's a lot of men getting prostate cancer.
Well, I guess so.
Yep. So
I never realized that.
Yeah, and also guys don't like to be treated. They don't like the idea of going and getting a digital rectal exam, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think stigmas that are placed upon us by our society, we don't want to go to the doctor and have a rectal exam and go home and tell our wives, hey, honey, I had a rectal exam this morning. So I think guys are more timid about going and getting treated. And what's important is the early detection. So if you detect it early enough before it's allowed to progress to the late stages, then it's much more treatable. Just like most other cancers, you want to detect them as early as possible.
So, ladies, talk to the man in your life.
Yes.
How's
tell him
that?
It's okay to get a digital rectal exam.
It's okay.
You'll survive.
Do this.
Yes.
It's really important that partners kind of watch out for their partners and
yes.
say, hey, you know, it's important.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched it with men in my own family, my father, my grandfather. They just don't want to go to the doctor. And I'm kind of the same way. I just, you know, we want to be manly men and we can handle anything and don't want to go to the doctor. And especially
manly.
When you get middle-aged. I think by the age of 50, you should start getting regular prostate checkups. But those who aren't getting those, they're taking a risk because 1 in 6 men will come down with prostate cancer at some point.
So being a risk taker in this case isn't appropriate.
I don't think so.
No,
not when the solution is quite simple.
Right, right. Be manly enough to go get that test. So you're working with other researchers and institutions, and collectively you've received support from the Cancer Prevention Research Institute of Texas. Can you share some of that story with us?
Yeah, so
I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, so as a result of the work I've done on developing prostate cancer drugs, I've given seminars and lectures all over the world, really. And as a result of those presentations over time, you meet different scientists and things. And I came into contact with a scientist by the name of Paul Webb at the Methodist Hospital Research Institute in Houston, who is also in a similar research field as I. And then we've also got into contact with a man named Jan-Åke Gustafsson, who was recruited from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, I believe, to the University of Houston a few years ago to run a new center. I believe it's called Center for Nuclear Receptors and Cell Signaling. So he is a world-renowned scientist in estrogen receptor research and things like that. So we got with them and we submitted a research grant to Cancer Prevention and Research Institute of Texas, and we were awarded close to $5 million over 5 years to pursue not only the drugs that we're currently working on, but alternative strategies for targeting prostate cancer as well. So
isn't it important for scientists to discuss activities and possibilities and brainstorm with one another?
Yes. And quite often it's even more important that those scientists come from different backgrounds because they bring different perspectives that you wouldn't have yourself, or if you're in the same room with a bunch of scientists who have identical area of research and expertise. So you want to bring in people with different backgrounds and differing viewpoints and things. And oftentimes it leads to big ideas, I think.
It certainly leads to creativity, that kind of being outside of your comfort zone or your box.
Many people, they even scientists or anything in life, you get this comfort zone and you just stay in it. But if you step out of it and try to pursue an area of research that you have no experience in, sometimes you can bring a unique perspective to that. And in fact, I was not considered a prostate cancer researcher until the last 2 years. I was just a molecular endocrinologist studying steroid hormone receptors, which are the proteins in the body that actually bind to the hormones and mediate the body's response to hormones.
You know what was going through my mind just now? I think penicillin was accidentally kind of came across because of a petri dish in a lab or something.
And quite honestly, a lot of major discoveries, there's an element of luck to it, just being in the right place at the right time and running into that result that leads you in that direction. And that's just the way it is. So
And thinking collectively but yet independently to come up with some creative solutions It's kind of amazing to me that nobody has touched this part of prostate cancer, the end time.
There are some reasons why. These receptors, which bind to testosterone, the protein that binds mm-hmm. testosterone, they're difficult proteins. They're very unstable and things like that. So it's kind of hard to go into in layman's terms, but they're difficult proteins to work with. And the site where most of the drugs we currently have bind is a perfect site for binding drugs to, but there's not other perfect sites. So it's a lot more challenging to develop drugs that target these proteins in different ways. And so it's been a long time coming to get to this point, I think.
And so you have to build on other research that has taken place before.
Yes, yes.
And
maybe 20 years worth of research, at least in my case, on a different protein that we now know regulates this receptor. So,
mm-hmm. Oh, that's fascinating. If you are just joining us on El Paso Primetime, I'm Florence Schwein, and my guest is Dr. Mark Cox, assistant professor here at UTEP. We are talking about some cutting-edge research that is taking place in the Border Biomedical Research Center. Mark, I don't know anything about the research center. Could you share some of that with me?
Yeah, so the Border Biomedical Research Center, we also call it the BBRC for short.
BBRC.
We like our acronyms in science. BBRC.
Uh-huh.
It really is a cutting-edge research facility. So I came here 4 years ago from the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona. And our facility here on the UTEP campus is much better equipped than we were at the Mayo Clinic.
By better equipped, what do you mean?
Research
Give
equipment.
Give me a picture of this lab.
Very expensive pieces of research equipment. For example, a mass spectrometer, which costs probably upwards of $500,000, $600,000. So we've got equipment here that I haven't seen at research facilities that would be considered, you know, top-notch, like the Mayo Clinic or mm-hmm. other institutions. So UTEP, as an institution, made the commitment many years ago to become a research-intensive institution, and I think they've done it. We've got the infrastructure now. To quote an old movie, you know, the Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. And uh-huh. I think that UTEP has built the infrastructure, and they're now attracting top-notch scientists that are competitive on an international scale, I think. So
that's very exciting for you.
Yeah,
I can just imagine walking into a lab and say, oh, my goodness, I love these toys.
Come on over. I'll give you a tour. Yeah. But the BBRC is a top-notch research facility. We have researchers in there that are researching anything from prostate cancer, in my case, to leukemia, to HIV, to flu virus. We've hired some new individuals that work on tuberculosis, and all of these individuals are pulling in lots of grant money, and mm-hmm. Which is good for the university, mm-hmm. And they're publishing a lot. So, yeah.
And that's good for all of us.
Yeah. I mean, if we bring in good scientists that are doing good research, it provides top-notch research experiences for our students. Students that are trained in an environment like that are going to be much better scientists in the future. So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I just wanted to pick up on researching on TB now, mm-hmm. because at one point we had a TB sanitarium mm-hmm. up in Cloudcroft.
Okay, and I didn't know that. Yes.
And they took young children and babies mm-hmm. away during the summer hot months. Mm-hmm. And TB kind of died out because
yes.
of science.
Yes.
But now there are new strains.
It's coming back, yep. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a TB researcher, but what I know is that a drug was developed, I believe it's called isoniazid, that pretty much eradicated TB. But now TB, as well as other bacterial strains and things, are emerging with resistance to the current drugs that we have to target them. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, if an individual gets a resistant form of TB, that's probably not a good scenario for them because we don't have any other drug options. So.
Right. And so
TB research is becoming much more important and probably much more fundable by mm-hmm. the National Institute of Health and National Science Foundation, et cetera.
Back in, about 1922, my grandmother died of TB, my mother's
oh, wow.
mother, and
yeah.
she was my mother was only 2 years old when mm-hmm. her mother died.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, we've come a long way,
mm-hmm. yep.
but almost full circle because those little
yeah,
germs out there
back.
Get smarter, don't they?
Yep. Yep.
So you came to UTEP, you said, in 2007, and before that you were at the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale and received your PhD from Tulane in New Orleans. during all of the time that you were working, there were some other aspects of health research that you were doing. And now you're doing a pilot program on developing monitoring systems for emerging contaminants in the Rio Grande with Dr. Liz Walsh.
Yes.
What's that all about?
Yeah, so really this goes back to when I was an undergraduate student. And I think this also goes to points to the fact that research experiences for undergraduate students are extremely important. Because when I was an undergraduate, I worked in a research laboratory that studied contaminants in the environment that acted like the hormone estrogen in the body and caused problems with reproduction, premature breast development, and prepubertal females, et cetera, et cetera. So I got my start in toxicology as an undergraduate, and that's what made me want to be a scientist, that experience. And so that's why I feel to this day that, that getting undergraduates in the lab is extremely important. So I went to Tulane University, and the first degree that I got postgraduate was a master's in public health, and it focused in toxicology. And I also did research in the area of toxicology and things for my master's degree. So as a result, I have a background in toxicology, and I still have an interest in it. And given my research area studying reproductive hormones and things, it's a natural fit that I am also interested in what we call endocrine-disrupting chemicals. And these are, as I said, chemicals in the environment that can act like the natural hormones that are produced in your body. And so if you're exposed to them, they can throw off your body's balance of hormones. And so, for example, if you're exposed to a compound called bisphenol A from plastics, that can
That's BPA.
You've heard a lot about it recently. Europe is starting to ban it in plastics and probably California as well. This is a compound that if it gets in the body, it can act just like estrogen does. And so it can promote anything that estrogen would normally promote at times when it probably shouldn't be promoted. So it can mess up reproduction. If pregnant mothers are exposed to it, the developing fetuses, it could have drastic effects on development because estrogen, testosterone, these hormones are extremely important for development of fetuses, both in the womb and after they're born as well. So, I have a background in toxicology, and I'm working with several individuals at UTEP, not just Dr. Walsh, but also Dr. Wen-Yi Lee in chemistry. She has a background in studying wastewater, so water that goes through the wastewater treatment plants and gets cleaned up so that it can be recycled, some of which is used in tap water, right? So she has a background in looking at wastewater for the presence of estrogens and how to remediate that or to remove them from the wastewater during the treatment process and things. So I've worked with her on studies looking at the effectiveness of wastewater treatment plants of removing estrogens and things like that. So as a natural consequence of all that, we're developing projects to look at all emerging. What we mean by emerging contaminants are pollutants in the environment that are emerging as being important that previously weren't known. And many of those actually stem from pharmaceuticals. So we call them pharmaceuticals and personal care products in the environment. So PPCPs, another acronym
PPCPs.
For you.
PPCPs.
So these are all
I can see me
medicines.
Now.
Yeah. So we take a lot of medicine as an industrialized nation. And
so you shouldn't be flushing it down your toilet, right?
Well, I mean, where else are you going to put it? If you put it in the landfill, it's still going to get in the environment. Yeah. So. But we take, for example, contraceptives. We metabolize those, but we're still excreting from urine usually metabolites and some amount of the original drug, probably in some cases, that are still estrogenic or act like progesterone, some of the, you know, the contraceptives that have hormone-like activity and things. And they're getting into the environment. And that's just one example. There's many of things that we take. Whether one of the most highly prescribed medications in the world is prednisone, which is a glucocorticoid. It's used to treat inflammation. And if that were to get in the environment at high levels, and this is a study we're doing with Dr. Lee right now to screen the Rio Grande for glucocorticoids.
Oh, really?
They could lead to they could contribute to obesity, to decreased immune function. So you could have a compromised immune system. All kinds of things that we see today. You know, we see increased infectivity, increased obesity, and other things. So, yeah.
And evidently, because some of our water supply, of course, is from the Rio Grande, besides the aquifer, et cetera, we can't take all of that out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're talking about thousands and thousands of probably contaminants and in many cases small amounts of things that are present because they're diluted out in a big river. You can't predict what's there. So how do you know exactly how to make a filtration system to remove everything, right? Plus, we have a unique situation. We're on the border with a country that's currently developing. They do have environmental laws and regulations like we do, but I don't think they have the oversight that we do. So we have situations of things being dumped in the river from the Mexican side.
Mm-hmm.
In Mexico, they still use things like paraquat, which is a herbicide that's highly toxic, that's banned for use in the U.S. But because
and
it can
DDT
be used in...
And DDT was banned how many years ago?
Yeah, right? Yeah, many, many, many years ago.
Yeah,
yeah, because it caused reproductive failure in birds, really, because it's an estrogen, basically, acts as estrogen. So the point is we're on the border, and we can't control what gets done in Mexico, but we can still be exposed to it through our common border, which is that river, right? So,
yeah, and if I remember right, years ago there was all the gene washing material that went back into the river.
Lots of things go back into the river. Yes, or back into the environment in general. Yep.
So, in talking about toxins, we hear so much about detoxifying the human body. First of all, how would you define toxins within the body? And then how do we get them in our bodies? I mean, we're talking about water to begin with.
Yeah, so first of all, in toxicology, one of the founding principles states that the dose makes the poison, right?
The dose makes the poison.
What that means is that anything can be in poison at the right dose, whether it's salt. For example, we need things like vitamin A, vitamin B. But if you let your child go and eat a whole bottle of Flintstone vitamins, they're most definitely going to have some adverse toxic effects, right?
Okay.
So those vitamins, which are supposed to be good for you, all of a sudden become a toxin or poisonous.
And that's a good point to make.
Yeah, so the dose makes the poison. There are a lot of bad things out there in the world, and they're all around us right now. I mean, there's probably some formaldehyde off-gassing out of that material in your wall right now there. But they're at minute quantities, right? So the question is long-term exposure to that harmful to you? And we just really don't have an answer for many of them. Because most things that are approved for human consumption or human use, whether it be commercial products like an ink pen or whatever, the federal government has determined through strict testing in animals, mice, rats, bacteria, whatever, that it's at a safe limit for you. However, remember those tests are in mice and rats and bacteria, so we can't be 100% sure. And there's plenty of examples of things that are very toxic in rats that aren't so toxic in humans and vice versa, right? But we can't do human studies, so we're stuck with making a best guess based on animal studies, whether something is safe for you or not.
So the air we breathe, the water we drink, what we touch.
Yeah, and I give plenty of examples when I teach class, and the students are just blown away at the things that they hear they didn't realize. A great example I often give is when you buy a new car.
Ooh, it smells like a new car.
And yeah, and people usually get in, take a big whiff, and go, ooh, I love the smell of a new car in the morning,
right?
But
I don't.
General rule, if you smell something, you're basically inhaling some type of molecule, right? And the new car, in the case of the new car smell, it's usually vinyl chloride coming out of the plastics, and formaldehyde coming out of the carpets and seating and things. And basically those are designated human carcinogens, or at least they're possible human carcinogens based on rat studies and things. So if you buy a new carpet for your house, you smell that smell, a new couch. The best advice is to let those air out. Increase the ventilation in your home for at least 48 hours after purchasing having new carpet installed. Paints or anything. You want to make sure that we don't have basements here typically in El Paso.
Right.
So you don't want to be storing paints and things in your house. Try to buy just enough that you need and get rid of the rest. You don't need to be saving it so that it can off gas and you're breathing all this stuff. But, I mean, you're getting formaldehyde from the plywood that your home's built with, from cosmetics, all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's plenty of examples I could sit here all day and go through.
I remember red dye number 5.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff. All kinds of stuff.
And I mean, when you simply
cook your food, this paper is not naturally white.
It's bleached.
It's bleached, and that bleaching process produces a small amount of dioxins, which are technically considered the most toxic substance known to man based on rat studies. But it turns out that dioxin, there was a population in Italy that was exposed big time to dioxins due to an industrial accident. And there's an Italian scientist that studied them for years, and there was no major increased incidence of cancer, birth defects, and things like that. So that's one of those cases where perhaps the rat studies weren't so accurate. But the point is, we're exposed to a lot of things. And you can't hide from them, but there's things you can do to minimize your risk.
So what can you do? Can the body cleanse itself in many ways?
The body has plenty of mechanisms that can metabolize foreign substances and excrete them in the urine or feces. Mm-hmm. So our body, in large part, gets rid of a lot of things that we're exposed to. So that goes into how much can you be exposed to before it's toxic. It determines individuals differ in their metabolic rates, and children can tolerate a lot less than adults because they're developing. Mm-hmm. Seniors who are perhaps already have some serious health illnesses, if they don't want to add insult to injury, they might want to minimize their exposures and things. And my advice is to not be using too many, chemical products. Don't be spraying air fresheners all over and breathing it in. And just try to avoid that kind of stuff because it's all synthetic man-made things. And although they've been determined to be safe based on animal studies, you just don't know for sure.
Yeah, probably less is more in this case.
Yes,
yeah, very much like it is in other areas. But what about, there's so many things out there that say detoxify your body, and I'm afraid that some of these things
All the
might,
herbal stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I hate seeing that in the grocery store. Yeah, most of that stuff is not proven. It's not a prescription medication, so it's not regulated by the federal government, which I suspect may be changing in the near future. And you're going to see a lot of those coming off the shelves. But I don't like a lot of those things. No.
In fact, it was the Real Grande Cancer Foundation that put us in touch with one another, for which I'm very grateful, Mark. This has been so enlightening. We need more people like you in the world. Also, our producer, Dennis Wu, also gets my gratitude today for making it possible to get this information to you over the airwaves. You've been listening to a Journey to Wellness program on El Paso Primetime. I'm Florence Schwein.
This is Passport to Texas. Birding is one of the fastest growing outdoor hobbies in the United States, and Texas and its parks are major birding hotspots. Our state park guy, Brian Fraser, tells us more.
You have hundreds of different bird species and incredibly rich and diverse birding habitats. From the lower Rio Grande Valley all the way up to the Panhandle in East Texas, you have this vast array and colors of birds. Now is the time to get out and enjoy them. You have the Great Texas Birding Festival. The 17th year is going on. It's tournaments, it's sit-ins. You can do birding checklists. You can help parks do birding counts. There's lots of different ways to get involved in a public way. Or you can just sit in your backyard by your bird feeder and watch the vast array of birds that will come there. But birding, identifying the species, take your binoculars, take your camera, take your kids, and show them just how enjoyable that can be to see those creatures that live here year-round or just seasonally.
Thanks, Brian. Find additional information at texasstateparks.org. That's our show for today, with funding provided by Chevrolet, supporting outdoor recreation in Texas because there's life to be done. We record our series at the Block House in Austin. For Texas Parks and Wildlife, I'm Cecilia Nasty.
Thanks for listening to this archive edition of El Paso Primetime. Louis Signs and Perspectives is up next. Join us again next Saturday afternoon for another edition of El Paso Primetime.